The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Welcome, everyone. And as we begin tonight, I'd just like to acknowledge that Common Ground, and I only live about 8 blocks from Common Ground, so I'm physically very close to the meditation center. And Common Ground is located on the traditional, ancestral, and contemporary homelands of the Dakota and the Ojibwe people. And this land holds great historical, spiritual, and personal significance to its original inhabitants, their descendants who live here today, and to their future generations. And we acknowledge the sovereignty of these nations and our obligation to live up to treaty agreements and our intention to rectify any harm that we have committed and those we continue to commit. So, and some of you may know that that where the Mississippi and the Minnesota rivers come together here in Minneapolis is the most sacred place to all the Dakota people. It is the creation site. So it is a very spiritual, powerful place. And tonight I'd like to talk about and discuss with you and hear your comments on what I've been thinking of as the paramis as public virtues. And most of us think of the paramis, and that is the purifying qualities of the heart and mind as matters of personal cultivation, the 10 Buddhist paramis, the qualities that we develop to negotiate the path that leads us to the end of suffering. And a few years ago, I began to wonder what our society would look like if we found a way to embed these personal virtues, these spiritual virtues, in our civic institutions and policies. And I started looking for examples of where it seemed that a policy or a practice actually embodied one of these Buddhist virtues. So tonight I'd like to share some of my reflections and findings with respect to 5 of the paramis: generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, and energy. And I hope to have plenty of time for us to discuss this. So the first parami is dana, or generosity, freely giving. And in public life, this might be finding ways to help people be less stressed in dealing with institutions and bureaucracies. And sometimes these are simple tweaks to the system, and other times it may require a reallocation of resources. But these are some examples. One which just gladdens my heart all the time is that the Hennepin County Library automatically renews books if there is no one waiting. You know, there was a time when you actually, this dates me, but you know, you actually had to take the books back to the library and sign them out again. But you know, the county renews the books automatically, and it if no one's waiting. And it notifies you by email when your books are due. And, you know, it's just a remarkable sort of thing that, and it doesn't, you know, it takes some tweaking, but it didn't take a tremendous amount of resources to do this. It's like, oh, this is something we could do that would make our patrons' experience better, would be helpful to them. Another example sort of along this theme is that in Hennepin County now, the court sends a text reminder to people about their upcoming court appearances. This may sound to you really simple, but for a lot of people who are kind of entangled with the legal system, whose lives are kind of chaotic, it's often challenging to remember, you know, if you've got a court date 3 months ahead, when you're supposed to be in court. And then people forget about it. They miss their court date. Then there's a warrant sent out, and it's and it just snowballs. It cascades. So now Hennepin County sends out a text, I think 3 days ahead of time, to everyone when they have a court date. I mean, it assumes everyone has a phone, but I saw a statistic today that nearly 100% of the U.S. population has a phone. So that's a wonderful example. Another one that I don't know if this is still the case, but it was in 2019. Many of you have heard how often people are stopped because they have a taillight out, particularly, you know, persons who are Black and brown, and you're stopped, you get a ticket, and then again, you have a court date, often, or a fine. But instead of giving people a ticket for a taillight that's not working, for a while, in Minneapolis at least, people were given a voucher to get the taillight fixed. And there's a a garage called Bobby and Steve's, and they tow cars, they do something. It's a big automotive services, gas station stuff. And they were one of the they were one of the funders for this. And I think a foundation put some money in. So it did take some resources, but this is so much smarter, because sometimes people don't get a taillight fixed because they just don't have the money to get the taillight fixed. So again, this is a wonderful instance where we see this parami of generosity helping people. It's a policy. Instead of penalizing people for not being able to get something fixed, why don't we help them get it fixed? Here are some things that I think could be done. I think I would love to see more fault tolerance in forms and applications. Fault tolerance is the idea that when you've got some sort of system, you anticipate that people are going to make mistakes, and so you make it hard for them to make a mistake. So for example, I can't tell you how many times I've been saved by my computer saying, do you really want to delete this, right? We get that little pop-up that asks us if we want to delete this. Do you want to save your changes? So that's an example of fault tolerance. The most dramatic place where we have fault tolerance is in commercial aircraft, where there are so many things for the pilot to be aware of that it's built into that the pilot may be distracted, may be making, not making really good decisions. And so commercial airlines, one of the ways they have really cut down on pilot-based accidents is to build in this kind of fault tolerance where the system asks you, do you really want to do this? It sort of responds to you in this way. So one of the places where I think fault tolerance is needed is in forms and applications. And for many years, I worked for the Minnesota AIDS Project, and I would often have clients who would get a form and they'd have a 10-day turnaround period. You know, this is often to do with housing or getting, some sort of voucher or getting something renewed. They'd have a 10-day turnaround period, and often people who would be very housing insecure or something, they'd be moving, so they might not be at the address where the mail goes, and you know, they might not get the letter for a week or more. But if they missed the deadline or if they made a mistake on the form, they would lose that that support. And so, and often the forms were not easy to understand. So fault tolerance seems to me to be, longer turnaround times, not penalizing for unintended errors. Greg just put in the chat that we should have fault tolerance, making masks easier to wear. That's some entrepreneur probably come up with something like that. So another place where I would see a role for generosity is in, and this is something that Hennepin County is experimenting with, is no bail alternatives. So in Hennepin County, for example, people who have committed a felony, but it's not a violent felony, they're not a danger, but they would ordinarily have to, they've been arrested, they'd have to pay bail to get out. The idea is that the accused person is assigned a social worker and works with the social worker to make sure that that person shows up in court, doesn't have to try to raise money for bail, because I think everyone understands that people are often in jail or accused of crimes in jail for nonviolent offenses, but they can't raise bail. So having a no bail alternative, or there are sometimes organizations that set up bail funds so that people who are arrested can apply to the, usually it's a nonprofit, and be bailed out. It's interesting that in Texas, there is now an effort to make what are called charity bail organizations illegal, that people who are arrested could still go to a commercial bail bondsman and get bail. But the state is about to, it's been proposed that charity bail be made illegal, which is really the opposite of generosity. But those are just some ideas about where I've seen generosity in public policy and where I think it could be improved. And I hope you all are making notes about where you think your ideas, keeping track of that. The second virtue that I wanted to talk about, the second parami, is sila, which is usually discussed as virtue or morality, but it's really the idea of non-harming. It's about the precepts. And when we look at sila as this kind of a virtue, we think about cause and effect, and really reflect on the harm that comes from our unskillful actions. And it appears to me that many current criminal justice policies emphasize punishment without rehabilitation. So there's a question about cause and effect with that, and that persons who are incarcerated are returned to the community often damaged by their experience. And I don't want to say, I volunteered in corrections for many years teaching meditation. Greg, who's on in our group tonight, has also done this. And there are instances where it seemed to me that, for example, that it wasn't until people were actually incarcerated that they were able to get mental health attention. And that's something that I saw over and over again. And some of that help was really, really helpful. But often in the justice system, people are harmed by their incarceration and not rehabilitated. So it would seem that non-harming policies might include, especially for young offenders, restorative justice circles, where individuals who have committed harm work on this long process to understand the harm that they've done and to work with the persons who have been injured to agree upon what restitution might look like. Another interesting place where Minnesota does have a policy that I think is in accordance with CELA is non-harming. It now allows infants born to incarcerated mothers to stay with them. And Minnesota apparently is one of the few states in the nation that actually allows this, that usually when an infant is born, that it is taken from to an incarcerated person, the child is taken away right away and is in the care of either family members or care of the state. But you know how much better it is for the infant and for the mother to be with each other, and we know that. I mean, that's something where we can clearly anticipate that this is a good, and the harm that comes from separating children and their mothers. There's something called the Good Country Index. Has anyone here, have a show of hands, has anyone heard of this before, the Good Country Index? Well, it's a really, there's a TED talk about it, which is kind of the easy way to find out about it, but there's also a very interesting website. And the Good Country, in terms of the unselfish country, it's not a domestic index. It is an international index that measures what each country on earth contributes to the common good of humanity and the planet. It looks at the global impact in terms of the harm, and it assesses on a whole number of scores of science and technology, culture, peace and security, climate, prosperity, equality, health and well-being. And it doesn't look at all at domestic impact. It looks at the kind of global impact. And the measures, the website, you can really do an incredibly deep dive into it. It talks about all of the sort of UN reports and all the ways the data is gathered. But it's a really interesting idea to look at countries and how much do they benefit the global population and how much do they harm us. And right now, and the most recent data is from 2019, and the top two countries were Sweden and Denmark. And in 2019, the US was number 38. It was between Malta and Croatia in terms of the good that it does. So this is just a suggestion. If I've got you curious about how do we look at the harm or the benefit a country does, looking at the Good Country Index is an interesting site. And this was just something I had not heard of at all before. And again, if you just Google Good Country Index TED Talk, you can, and I'm blanking on the name of the person who developed this. It's been going on for quite a while. It's certainly worth learning about. The third parami that I want to talk about is nakama, which is renunciation, giving something up voluntarily even if it's a sacrifice. And one of the places I thought about this was for people who live in Minneapolis. Minneapolis passed a very controversial 2040 housing plan that got national attention because it was the first city to abandon zoning for single-family housing. Now in Minneapolis, if you have a property that is zoned for a single-family house, you could build a triplex on it. And there are some other more adventurous plans about denser housing, because housing has been such a crisis. This has been a very hard pill for some people to swallow. And when this was being considered, as I said, I live close to Common Ground in Seward, where there are a number of duplexes and some apartment houses, but they're also parts of my neighborhood that are, you know, really lovely single family houses. And there was a lot of discussion about ruining the character of the neighborhood. And there are signs all over the city about, you know, don't ruin our neighborhoods. And it, Sunday, in fact, there was an article about trying to do slightly denser housing in St. Louis Park. And the response to it, I mean, people said things like, if you build multiple family housing, you'll just have an increase in crime. You'll see more cars broken into. I mean, clearly, racial assumptions about who lives in multifamily housing. But we know that there is a need for housing. And, I thought, well, what if a house on my block were to have a triplex? And I think, well, it wouldn't be my preference, but it's really important that people have housing. And my preference shouldn't matter about this. My aesthetic preference shouldn't matter. At the end of my street, there's an industrialist. It's right along the Greenway, so it's right now a little industrial corridor. But I know in the city plan, that's when the owner of that business, Empire Glass, sells his building, that there's going to be probably a 3 to 5 story apartment house built on that. I think, okay, be a lot more traffic on my block, and I like how things are now, but that's kind of irrelevant because there really is this need for more housing. So deal with more traffic. It's just kind of the way it needs to be. So that's kind of one example where we can see sometimes where our preferences might, we have to give up our preferences for the good of the many. And housing is such a tremendous need for housing that it seems to me that that's something when we're asked to give something up like that, that we should really consider. Another really interesting example of renunciation, and I think this is kind of the big one in our time, is the issue of reparations. I mean, many of us find ourselves unwitting beneficiaries of settler colonialism, of redlining, of systemic racism, and there's a really lively discussion about what do we do to address these benefits that we often didn't ask for, but that we clearly have from, especially settler colonialism is such a clear example. And if you would like to read an interesting and controversial suggestion, in the 2021, May 2021, Atlantic Monthly, there's a very interesting article called Return the National Parks to Native Occupation. And it's a proposal to have the national parks return to tribes, and they often were, you know, sacred sites to begin with, like Yosemite was an incredibly sacred site. And that it wouldn't be that the parks would no longer be national parks. They would still be national parks and, you know, open to anyone to visit, but they would be administered by the tribes, and tribal people could live in the national parks and they could hunt in the national parks. And and David Troyer, who is a wonderful historian and scholar and writer, wrote that article. And I think there are 85 million acres in the national parks. And he said it wouldn't be what the native people gave up, but it would be certainly a gesture. And he argues why native people have had experience in various kinds of administration of complex things. And he says, you know, we're really set up to do this. We have a lot of experience dealing with complex land issues. So again, that's just an interesting thought about one way reparations might look like. Georgetown University sold 280 enslaved persons to a plantation in Louisiana in the late 18th century. And they have made an effort since then to identify the descendants, and they've been fairly successful in identifying quite a few descendants of those original people who were sold to a plantation in Louisiana so that they could expand and support their space. And they offer priority admission and free tuition and board to any descendant who wants to go to Georgetown. And that's what it's a gesture, at least. Netflix, interestingly, Netflix has just made $100 million commitment to bank a portion of its holdings with lenders who focus on Black communities. Now, this is a tremendous idea of all of their wealth, that they put $100 million in banks and in financial institutions that primarily serve Black communities. And there have been reparations before. In the 1990s, there were reparations made to the descendants of people who were in the internment camps in Japan, and there was an apology. And Germany paid reparations to Israel after the Second World War. I mean, people say, well, who's ever paid reparations? There have been many ways of attempting to do this, and it's just something, if we really take this idea about renunciation to heart, and we try to imagine in public policy, I think this is a really fertile place to look. So, and then the virtue of panya, or wisdom. I think one of the most succinct expressions of wisdom is Ruth King, the wonderful author of Mindful of Race. Ruth King says, everything is impermanent, imperfect, impersonal. That's wisdom. So part of wisdom is that, you know, there are no perfect solutions. There are only skillful means. And I think this is something for us to consider. Wisdom sees the folly in short-term solutions, short-term gains. Wisdom takes a long and broad perspective. You know, I think everyone has probably heard that in many indigenous communities, people talk about planning for the seventh generation. taking that into account in anything you do. In art conservatorship, the idea with that is you never do anything that you can't undo. That's kind of the wisdom of art conservation. So when we look at this idea that everything is impermanent, imperfect, impersonal, we live in a changing world. It's very dynamic. There's lots that we can't control. But we can certainly see the consequences of some of our actions, and we can find some skillful means to address them. And probably, the most clear example is in the environment and climate change. What we're all have been so acutely aware of this summer, because no matter where you live in the United States right now, you are probably aware of more extreme weather, ranging from drought to flood to fire. Looking at things like renewable energy, mitigating. I mean, there are lots of very creative ideas about how we can mitigate some damage. There was a recent piece in a New Yorker magazine about how in New York City, when Hurricane Sandy came, it just like swept over Staten Island and 24 people died. And there was so much damage. And, they said that looking at what happens with storm surge, that often the kind of natural barriers that would mitigate against the terrible destruction of storm surges have been done. What people have done is they built seawalls, things that are hard and high. And there's this just amazing plan to remake the oyster beds around New York Harbor. And it's very ingenious about, you've probably also heard about trying to create reefs, where reefs have been washed away to recreate, they're called artificial reefs, but eventually they become inhabited by lots of living creatures. So to do things that are mitigating activities to deal with climate change, and they're not quick fixes. A lot of to sort of restore some of these natural systems will take decades, if not in some cases maybe a generation. But there really it is this sense of how do we repair, how do we restore, how do we how can we act to ameliorate some of the harms that have been committed? And wisdom really takes this longer point of view. Another, I think, for another area, for example, universal preschool, that, wisdom teaches us, all the data teaches us that early education is, one of the best investments that can be made. And it's interesting that it was a study that came out of the Minneapolis Fed, where they, or the Minnesota Fed, the Fed that's the bank that's here in Minneapolis, that they did a study, and they thought, one of the most efficient ways of spending money in terms of a benefit is preschool education, universal preschool education, and probably universal health care, access to competent and culturally appropriate health care for everyone. These are areas where we can take this kind of long and broad view and understand that there's no single simple fix. There are lots of ways that we can use skillful means, and there may have to be lots of different ways. It's not like a single solution. And then the last one I want to talk about is parami. It's virya in Pali. And it's usually translated as energy, which always just seems to me to be kind of a funny thing to talk about virtue as energy. But actually, it means kind of exertion in mental development, facing what is difficult, heroic effort. And I don't know if any of you remember that a couple of years ago, Ayoyun Tudney once said at Common Ground, you know, where is the Buddhist virtue of courage? Why don't we have courage as a virtue? And actually, Joseph Goldstein says that courage is a perfectly appropriate translation of this Pali term virya, because it really is facing what is difficult, a kind of heroic effort. So it seemed to me that I thought, okay, is this one though where we actually see this in policies? Are there courageous policies facing what is difficult? I mean, it's really easy, I think, to see courage in people like, you know, Brian Stevenson, who worked so hard to end life imprisonment for juvenile offenders, finally got the Supreme Court to declare that for juveniles who were sentenced as juveniles to life imprisonment, the Supreme Court finally decided that that was cruel and unusual punishment. So you can have a juvenile who is sentenced as an adult to life imprisonment, and that still sticks. But if a person is a juvenile, they can no longer be sentenced to life imprisonment. I mean, and this was working for years and years and years. Brian Stevenson, who wrote the amazing book, Just Mercy, and working, for example, against capital punishment. You know, that is a campaign that has been going on for decades and decades and decades. We might think about voter registration as another example where that would require, this sort of sustained effort, facing what is difficult, doing that hard work. And we have, you know, wonderful examples of people who have really done that. Both people who have lived long lives. I think of the Buddhist philosopher Joanna Macy, who has worked, talks about the great turning, who has worked so long and on environmental issues. And then a very young person like Greta Thunberg, who again is really inspiring. So my question to you is, you know, like, what if we really took it upon ourselves as part of our practice to consistently make an effort to see that these paramis were inserted in public life? You know, what if that was one of the lenses that we used to decide what's worth our efforts and our support in terms of candidates or policies? What if we were to take courage to heart and engage in activities, you know, that works for a more generous, virtuous, unselfish, and equitable future? So I would love to hear your comments and your thoughts. This is something I've been trying to write about for a while. So if you've got any suggestions of other examples, or if you have any criticisms, I'm always welcome for that too. So please just unmute yourself and jump in. There's actually across the room, but there's a book called Buddhist Economics. That's an interesting book that does talk about a lot about interdependence, and if we approach from this sort of abundance standpoint, from our interdependence, and look at economic theory in that way. Thanks. Other responses. Oh, thank you for your examples. That's, yeah, not only the individual, but the family. Yeah, and that's a really important thing when we think about relieving suffering, to, again, look at that sort of big picture of who's harmed, who's involved. It's sort of like the mother and the infant, keeping the mother and the infant together, that, you know, the harm that's done both to the mother and the infant and the family, probably in taking that infant away from the mother. So, other responses. Part of my thinking about this was actually inspired by listening to a talk a couple of years ago by the meditation teacher and psychotherapist Akinchino. He's not a monk anymore, but he still uses his monk name, Akinchino, and he is a Swiss psychotherapist. And he actually talked about equanimity as impartiality. And he said that is such an important virtue in our, in the legal system, that you want a judge to be impartial. You want the law to be applied impartially. And so equanimity, he thought actually, he was actually talking about the Brahma Viharas and how they might be understood in a more social context. And I thought that was really, really interesting to take that aspect of them, because sometimes we talk about equanimity, you know, as being steadfast, not falling to extremes, and that idea of not going to extremes is kind of that idea about being impartial, not swayed by preference or by something that wouldn't be appropriate. And I also think, for example, we would like our referees and umpires in sports to be impartial, to have this kind of equanimity. It probably means more in sports where you have, you know, people screaming at the umpire and the fans and the players sometimes yelling at the umpire, but you, or the referee. And you want those people whose job it is to apply to apply the law or apply the rule. And I know someone who is a judge and who has talked about the importance and sort of the mental discipline of being really open to what the evidence and the law indicates. And this person said, you know, sometimes I go into a case thinking, oh, sounds like I'm, having an idea about which one would prevail, and said that it's often the case when I really look at the evidence and look at the law, the circumstances and the law, that, and this is more, these are not criminal cases, but this would be, contractual law or tort law, things like that. How that sort of discipline about equanimity and impartiality. So that would be my response to that, Carrie. And it's not something I thought of, but I heard someone say, "Oh, that's really pretty interesting." And sometimes, that we have the experience when we see someone who embodies a kind of a virtue, embodies that sort of steadfastness, embodies that kind of equanimity, that often does have some influence on other people. I mean, I think that, to see sometimes, he's always used this example, but, you know, the Dalai Lama and how he talks about, you know, not hating the Chinese and wishing them well and, you know, not wanting people to suffer, about his equanimity about his own life and his circumstances and his humility, you know, the way he greets whenever he's at a hotel or a convention center. He always asks if he can go and see the people who are working there, you know, the caterers and the janitors and all of that. So, you know, when we have people like that, that we can see how they live the paramis, it's often just such an encouragement. And it's like I say to myself, oh, human beings are capable of doing that. You know, it really is. I could aspire to having, you know, some of that equanimity or that kindness. So it's not to feel that, you know, I'm compared to the Dalai Lama, you know, I'm such a toad, but human beings are capable of that. And to just really rejoice in that in a way. Other comments that people might have. I think this is where historical perspective is really useful. You know, like what is, you know, how were things 50 years ago? How were things 100 years ago? And to really take the big picture of how change has occurred. And when we, you know, look at, for example, policing, that, you know, before there were Miranda laws, that, you know, if we look at that, that often, you know, the police and law enforcement stood by as people were lynched, you know, that, that women who, were, you know, domestically abused, that they were not taken seriously. They were told to, you know, go home and be nice to their husbands. You know, I mean, in almost any social issue, if we look back and take this perspective of, well, what was it like 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago? You know, I mean, we no longer execute children. And that was done, you know, well into, I don't know if it was done in America, but, well, it was certainly done with children who were enslaved. They were executed. But, you know, we can think about the changes that have happened. And although they may be seem really slow, and when we look at something now, we can be really frustrated. We can say this is, you know, compared to 50 years ago, we've made some progress. And I think that's, you know, what we have to do to stay steady on the path, and also to really look for examples where people are doing good, where they are making things better for other people, where they're helping. So I think that, you know, having a sort of positive inclination to see, you know, well, where in my city do I see, you know, generosity? Like the library now has, at least I've used the East Lake Library. They have a social worker there twice a week. I think what a great use of a social worker, someone who's just there to help people figure out what resources are available, maybe to help them figure out forms. I mean, that's just a terrific idea of having a social worker come to the library and just be available. Sort of like, you know, I was used to homework helper at the library, but now there's the social worker for their parents. And what a great idea that is. Joanna Macy talks a lot about discontinuous change. Now, she's worked for the environment, she said, and she said, you know, it goes either way, but, you know, water before it reaches 32 degrees is just water. But once it gets to 32 degrees, you have this really quick discontinuous change where it becomes ice. Or, you know, in the physical world, I think also about, you know, I think it was in 2013, I was phone banking, trying to prevent, to have people vote not to outlaw gay marriage in the Minnesota Constitution. And I thought that was kind of an uphill battle. I was afraid that we would not prevail, but we did. And gay marriage was not made illegal. But within 2 years, gay marriage was in the whole United States. I mean, you know, there was sort of that very quick, discontinuous change. And so, you know, that's something that we can also take heart of, although remembering that it goes both ways. You know, there are tipping points either way, but we can take heart. So let's just share the merit. And thank you all so much for being here this evening. But if there's any goodness to our practice, any benefit or blessing or merit, we would, if we could, gladly, happily, joyfully share it with others. In fact, if we could, we would give it all away. We would give it to our parents, our teachers, our friends, our family, our Dharma community, our municipal community. We would give it to the people we like and also to the people we don't really like. We would give it to the people we know and the millions upon millions of people we don't know. And in addition to the two-leggeds, we would share our blessings with the four-leggeds, the many-leggeds, the winged, the scaly, the slimy, the finny. All beings everywhere. May all beings find a path of peace. May all beings be free from suffering. And thank you all very much. And Shelley should be here next week. So take care, everybody.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.